Welcome to Work with Purpose, a podcast about the Australian public sector and how it serves the Australian community. My name is David Pembroke. Thanks for joining me. As we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we are meeting today, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing contribution they make to the life of our city and this region. I'd also like to acknowledge the custodians of all the lands from where anybody listening to this podcast is joining us from. So each year during NAIDOC Week, Australians are invited to celebrate the history, culture and achievements of our First Nations people. While more and more people in Australia recognise the crucial role that our First Nations people play in looking after country and making Australia a place we can all enjoy and love living in, First Nations people still face significant adversity, which makes it difficult for them to pursue higher education or reach senior executive positions in either the public or private sectors. Today, we'll speak with Lisa Conway, a Yorta Yorta woman who has overcome major adversity and privation in her life to succeed in a career of helping others. She's currently researching the critically important topic of cultural responsiveness in order to improve service delivery for minority groups here in Australia. Now, Lisa Conway is a Sir Roland Wilson Pat Turner Scholar at the Australian National University and is also a national manager with Services Australia, and she joins me now. Lisa, welcome to Work with Purpose.
Thank you, and I'm here on Wathaurong country here, so acknowledging their country as well.
Fantastic. So, listen, a story always has a beginning, and I'd love to know what your story is.
My story? Well, I guess I am a Yorta Yorta woman, as you know, so my family is quite interesting. My father, his mother's from Stolen Generations, and my mum is actually a forgotten Australian, so grew up in a pretty interesting time, and I guess, eventually one day found myself in a Centrelink office looking for support, and was sort of guided down the road of getting a scholarship to go and study social work and totally changing my life, really. So from that point, ended up working in government, and I've now been in government for 17 years at what was Centrelink and now Services Australia, and now find myself studying, as you said, doing my PhD at ANU.
Now, I don't want to be too nosy, but can you just sort of explain to us and to many people who are listening who have never had to live through the trauma of growing up in the circumstances that you did, but could you share with us just what that meant to be, the child of someone who was from the Stolen Generation, someone who was forgotten? Just what was that like and what did it mean?
I guess for me, it was what that meant was is that my parents, neither of them had grown up in an environment where they knew how to be parents themselves. Like, they'd never been parented. They'd grown up in institutions. And it meant that we have that intergenerational trauma where people, experienced a lot of hardship, a lot of abuse, and didn't have parenting skills. And I guess so, my kids are the first in five generations to not have grown up in some form of state care at some point. So, yeah, it's a tough time, and you face discrimination. Because of my skin colour, I don't have the dark skin of the stereotypical Indigenous person, so I quite often felt like I wasn't accepted as a white person, but then also would be questioned about whether I was Indigenous. So it's an interesting time growing up without those things that are in place to support you to be nurtured and reach your maximum potential. So, yeah, it was a challenging time.
And again, I don't want to push you too far, but are there stories that you could share with us that could help us to better understand just exactly, what life was like growing up in that type of environment?
Well, I guess there's things about my family, like growing up in a country school where everybody in that town were the local farmers, and they were all related. And then there was my family, who were my dad's extended family, who were all considered what they called the tip rats. So we'd be called the tip rats at school and by people around. And even when you do well for yourself, people would sort of say, you know, oh, she's not like the rest of them. And so you get this really complex sort of feeling of, you know, trying to be proud but still being ashamed, and that was really hard. And right up till even after I left home, like when I first started at Centrelink, working at Centrelink, I was living in my car for the first 6 weeks, and like, you know, going into work every day trying to get, you know, that government pay slip that would give me the chance to get my own house, and going into work every day and pretending that I'd been to the gym and having a shower at work before I started for the day, with them not knowing that I was living in the car park in the shopping centre at night. Yeah.
Where did you find the resilience to just keep going? How where did that come from?
That's a really good question, and it's something that I quite often ask myself, you know, what is it? How do we break these cycles? And I guess for me, part of it is that I am academically, I do okay. So I think that some education was something drilled into me. And so I always had that bit of a background for me. But I guess the real resilience for me, I think, though, is about knowing my why. Like I've got this ancestral mandate, I guess, that my job is to make differences for people. And so I always just had to keep moving forward. And my kids, I guess, for me, when I had kids, that was a real wake-up call. It was time to break the cycle. I needed things to change. And so I needed to make that difference for my own kids, but then it became a bigger thing. I needed to make that difference to my people in general. And so you just keep moving forward. I guess that's what it is. It's not that I don't know that I see myself as more resilient than other mob. It's more that I just grab the opportunities and just keep going.
Who was the mentor who pushed you towards an understanding and appreciation that probably the only way out for you was through education?
Ironically, it started with my father. My dad, he only did halfway through year seven, or form one it was back then, and by then he was in between care and on the streets in Melbourne. And so he felt that he never had that opportunity, didn't have education, and he and a lot of people in my family felt really strongly about education. Education is something that nobody can ever take away from you. You can lose your home, you can lose, you know, you have your family torn apart, but if you've got an education, nobody can take that. And I guess it started there. But after that, ironically, it was through Centrelink and so by being a customer, going in there and then having career counselling from them to say, hey, you should go and study, you know, you can do this. And from there, I've just always been really lucky. I've had lots of mentors within the public service who, I guess, and this is what we need is the people that are going to champion you when, you know, they believe in you and you don't believe in yourself. And that's really makes a huge difference.
Look, and I'm not going to push too much further, but I just quickly, before we go, I just want to walk back to something you said, which is just horrendous, that you and your family and your friends were described as tip rats. That just is horrendous to think that would have been said to you. And looking back from where you are now, how do you understand that? And this will be the last question around that before we sort of move into the other areas of the conversation. But that just was like a punch in the guts when you said that word.
Yeah. I think the saddest part for me about all that is that at the time, we accepted it. It was almost like I had been called that for so long growing up that it didn't occur to me that it wasn't okay for people to see us that way. It was just more of a sense of shame about that's who we are and that's how it is. Reflecting back, like I can see that was the culture of Australia in the, you know, we're talking the 1970s and 1980s, and that was a culture, like that sort of racism was quite overt. It was really out there, and And yeah, it was a standard that was acceptable in the community and was acceptable even to us. And I guess the difference now is that I would never stand for that now. Like I would never stand for that. And I guess that's how far Australia really has come. I know we've got a long way to go, but I think that Australia's come a long way in that would never happen to my children in the school grounds now. And if it did, I'd be the first person down there to say something about it. Yeah.
Great. Well, listen, thank you very much for sharing that personal history with us, because I think it does help to locate just how challenging some of these attitudes are, some of these mindsets are that we need to perpetually confront in order to make progress. We can't walk away from it, but we do need to talk about it so we can build that deeper understanding. But your journey, as you say, you went to Centrelink as a customer, but before you started working for Centrelink, it was down this path of being a social worker. But I read in an interview with the Geelong Independent that your family often feared social workers. So can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, and I guess having family that have been, you know, removed for one reason or another, whether they were like stolen in that traditional sense of the stolen generations, or if it was just people taking from our families because of neglect or other issues, what it meant was is that we had a genuine fear of social workers, because to us they meant child protection or they meant government workers, and it was about people who were out to destroy our families when obviously that's not necessarily what social workers are meant to be. And I found it really ironic that I was told that the right career for me after doing this career counselling would be social work. social workers have had a lot to be responsible for during that stolen generation era. And we would move interstate. We'd move, you know, to Queensland and back a few times to avoid child protection, to try and keep us kids within our family, because in my family, that keeping your family together was the safest thing to do, because when my parents grew up away from family, they were subjected to a lot of abuse in you know, children's homes and you know, so for my family, they're trying to keep us safe from the people who are meant to be keeping us safe.
In an earlier answer, you did mention that, you know, you feel this greater responsibility now, not just to your own family, but to more broadly. Your PhD research is in fact looking into ensuring that cultural responsiveness, that it does underpin policy and decision making. So in fact, Centrelink social workers are currently required to undergo cultural responsiveness training that you in fact developed. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is cultural responsiveness?
Yeah, so cultural responsiveness is very much about understanding that we all have different cultures and we all have different experiences that influence our culture and our worldviews. And so to take it back to our conversation about social workers, for example, if we were to be culturally responsive, if an Aboriginal person came into a Centrelink office and they were experiencing hardship or like homelessness or something, that they might actually, rather than reach out to a social worker and want to engage with them and talk to them about that, because of the cultural differences, an Aboriginal person going into a white government organisation could be quite fearful about sharing the fact that they're struggling, because they're already worried that their children could be taken from them. So, you know, they've got that level of trauma about concern. So reaching out for help can sometimes mean being vulnerable and opening yourself up to actually being under scrutiny of somewhere like child protection. So really, cultural responsiveness. In the past, we'd say cultural awareness, which was about let's learn as much as we can about Indigenous culture, so that we can engage better with, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. But that's not enough, because like I might be a Yorta Yorta woman, but there might be another person who's a Yorta Yorta woman, but they have grown up in a different experience. They might have grown up on country. They might have only found out yesterday that they're connected to Yorta Yorta people. We all have these different experiences. And so it's about understanding, though, that it can be quite different, but also understanding that you yourself will have biases and experiences yourself that will actually change how you might approach a conversation with somebody or how you make decisions about them. So it just means that it's really important to be thinking about the experience of the person you're working with and how they might experience in your culture, how the cultures intersect, and then, you know, accounting for that and dealing with the imbalance of power and the fear that might be, you know, felt by like an Aboriginal person coming in. So
would it be fair to say it's sort of the applied end of cultural awareness, and really it's about equipping our public servants with the tools to be able to, I suppose, deal with their clients appropriately. So is it that they've got that ability not just to know but to be able to do something about the situation of the client who would be sitting in front of them?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's application, I guess, because and quite often that's what happens. We teach people about Indigenous culture, but then what do you do with that? How do you actually use that in your day to day? And probably the most important aspect of it too, I guess, David, is that cultural humility is a really important part of this. So we teach people about Indigenous culture, but then they need to understand that they need to have the humility to realise, okay, I'm not an expert in this person. They're the expert, and I need to, even though I've got the bit of an understanding of what their culture is about, I need to now let them be the expert and tell me what that means to them and how I best work with them.
How long does it take to acquire the skills to be adequate? I suppose it's a lifelong, you know, it's like a lot of skills. You can always improve. But in your experience, how long does it take people to become culturally responsive or effectively culturally responsive in their work?
I feel like I'm still learning, and I think that, well, to give you an example, social workers already have a degree, and then we put them through basically a 12-week training package, so a couple of hours every week where you're working on it. So the thing about it is that some people might never get there because you need to learn, you need to have that really strong self-awareness. You need to be able to challenge yourself and have people around you who can challenge you and say, I think you're a bit biased in how you're looking at this. You need to sort of think about the lens you're using to look at this. So but you're right, it's absolutely an ongoing process, and you need to be constantly reflecting. And because culture evolves as well, culture's not, you know, stagnant. So it's about understanding that those things can change and that you need to always be checking in that your knowledge is up to date about various cultures and your own biases, because they change as well.
So inside the APS reform agenda, the public sector is focusing on this specific area where it's looking to set the standard for employment and cultural competency.
Yeah.
Why is it important that the public sector is culturally competent and culturally responsive?
I guess it's because for us to be effective as an institution or as the APS is that we need to be able to build policies and design and implement policies that are fit for purpose. So, which is fine when the majority of people in Australia are white Australians. So, because at the moment we've got, that's the dominant culture, is that a white Australia, because obviously that's been our majority for so long. But as time changes, that's not who we're working with anymore. We have to be able to represent the society that is around us. So that means that we need to have people coming in who might have disabilities. We need people who are multicultural. We need Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and they need to be able to come in and to get the strength of that diverse workforce. We need to know that they are actually able to bring their whole selves to work, because that's how we get that diversity. And I heard a really interesting comment when I was in Canada recently about currently a lot of public services, they recruit for diversity, so they bring in all those people for diversity, but then they onboard for assimilation. We sort of have all these policies around the policy and procedures reinforce that to act in a certain way when really we want to bring out that diversity.
What were you doing in Canada?
It was really exciting as part of our – so part of my scholarship is that you get a travel allowance. So I spent 6 weeks in Canada and I spent a few weeks living with a Gitxsan chief and got to go around and meet a lot of First Nations communities around British Columbia. And then I spent 3 months with the Canadian Public Service and sort of a bit of knowledge dissemination, I guess, teaching them a little bit what we've been doing, learning what they're doing and hopefully giving me some ideas about – some of the pitfalls from the way they work now, which is sort of more closely aligned to self-determination of their First Nation communities, and you know, having a lot of their service delivery now is done by Indigenous organisations, and looking at the strengths, but also looking at where some of the issues might be, so that I can think about what might be coming for us in the future and how we can change it.
Now, this is completely unfair, but I'm going to put you on the spot. What's one thing you learnt from your time with the Gitxsan chief, and what's one thing that you learnt in your time with the Canadian Public Service?
So the one thing I learnt from being with the Gitxsan chief, I think, is the value of vulnerability. I think that about you don't need to be the expert in your culture to be the best advocate for your culture. So it was about that. I think before I left, that in my view, elders, and the way I see elders in Australia, is that you have to have all the knowledge and you're, you know, got the expertise and the wisdom. Whereas the Gitxsan chief, she was very comfortable in herself that that she didn't necessarily have all of the wisdom, but she knew how to harness it from others. And I thought that was a real strength. And the other was, what was your
the other? Public sector. You had 3 weeks with the public sector, and you said it's interesting that you were saying that they are perhaps in some ways more mature in the way that they deal with their First Nations people. But what was one thing that you took from them?
Well, interesting enough, I went there thinking that they were more advanced than the Australian Public Service with how they work with their Indigenous peoples, and in some ways they are, but I also noticed that because they now have Indigenous communities, sort of Indigenous organisations delivering services themselves, that they have sort of let go of building cultural capability within their public servants.
They've outsourced the responsibility.
When I think that that's not the answer, because they're still guiding and creating new policies. So I felt that was a gap. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So let's turn the spotlight back onto the APS. So are there any gaps in the public sector, or what are those gaps in its current approach to cultural responsiveness?
I think that the gaps that I see is very much about we're very good now at sort of trying to identify Indigenous culture and understanding what Indigenous culture is and how it might impact, but we're not looking at our own culture as decision makers. For example, we're not appreciating the culture of the people within the public service, and also the public service itself has a culture and our policies. And so by focusing only on Indigenous culture, we're sort of missing the boat a little bit in being able to change our mindset and culture internally to be more culturally capable. So if the focus is always on Indigenous culture, we're not really focusing on what the APS can do differently from their own cultural perspectives. And I think it's a bigger gap than just the mob. I think that if we were able to be more culturally responsive, that's there's some real wins there for other diverse groups, you know, for people with disability, for example. If we made sure we learn a bit about people with disability, but then also thought about what about the ableist group and how does that impact that group, it's going to strengthen it overall. So, and I guess I had a perfect example. Somebody from Disability Council of Australia said the other day, Diversity Council of Australia, she mentioned the other day that when you build a building, at the moment you might build it, the default is to build a building with stairs, which automatically means that you have to change it if somebody needs a wheelchair. But if every building standard was built with a ramp, then we would have it. It would be a different ball game. It would mean that everybody could use it from the start. And why don't we do? Why don't we build our policies that way? Why don't we build policies in a way that automatically include everybody, rather than have to add it on later? It's a challenge, though.
That's a huge challenge. But if I was to hand you this magic wand that I've got in my hand at the moment, and you were able to make two or three decisions that would really help the APS, you know, strengthen this ability of, you know, cultural responsiveness, what are those changes that you would make?
The first change I would make would be to run training for every single public servant around how to understand what their cultural identity is. So that would be about, you know, understanding their family values, the sort of culture they've grown up in, and how that impacts them now, how that comes out in the way they make decisions or how they view the world, because I think that's something that's missing. I'd also make me a secretary. Just thought I'd throw that in. Let's hope Gordon's listening. Look, I guess that if I had a perfect world, I would go through and do a discourse analysis of every policy document, every procedure that we have, and reset the APS and how it approaches things, because we're not starting with a blank canvas. We've got a white canvas, and it means that we really, at the moment, when we try to increase cultural capability, we're sort of trying to build onto something that's already there, when it would be nice to be able to start fresh.
But exactly. But it is encouraging that it's being called out in the APS reform. So that sort of gives it that legitimacy and gives it that priority. So it's then really about maintaining progress from there and not falling back once you make some progress. So do you have any advice for people who are listening now thinking, okay, I'm going to take this challenge on. This all makes perfect sense to me. And I think the key word that you used a little bit earlier on was humility, you know, that people really have to, dunk themselves in a big vat of humility and to really, you know, probably unlearn a whole lot of things and really listen and to be present with this opportunity. But how do we maintain, there's good intention, but how do we make sure we make progress, but then how do we maintain progress?
It's a really good question. And I think that it is the humility, and it's that being reflexive. So it's about constantly, I think one of the best things that's happened to us is having Gordon DeBruyl come in, because I feel like he does have that humility around, we don't have to be the experts, and if we make mistakes, it's okay to own it, and that's how we learn. And I think that's a really important way forward for the APS. And I think for because you can't just become culturally responsive and just stay that way, it's about that constant learning, that constant journey, and reflecting on checking in with your working, if you're working with people who are Indigenous, checking in with them, you know, what makes you culturally safe in the workplace? What do we need to do differently? How do you think we're going? What's our scorecard like? And I think that's the other thing. Our scorecard needs to be marked by community, not by the APS. At the moment, I feel that we score ourselves, and I think that we need to have more of that feedback from community. And I do think, I'm really excited. Like, I do feel like the environment's changed. I think that we're on a different path, and I think it's the right path for improving that cultural capability.
So listen, just before we wrap it up, because we're coming close on time, just in terms of other First Nations people who, I don't know, may in fact be in, or may have been, or might today be in the circumstance that you were in all those years ago when you walked into that Centrelink office and started to think about your future. What advice do you have to them about being able to equip themselves so that they can not just survive, but they can thrive in this environment and perhaps, you know, start to make their way through to these leadership positions that we spoke about earlier?
It's a great question, because the thing is that I'm no different to most mob out there. We all, almost all of us have had that experience of impact from intergenerational trauma, and whether we're public servants or not, we're all facing those same sort of issues. And I think it's about just knowing that you're no different to anybody else in the public service, you just got to keep moving forward. And I think for me, to stay resilient and to keep going, it's about understanding your why. You've got to know why you're there and what you're doing and to work towards that. And I think the other thing is to tell people, don't be afraid to tell people you're interested in leadership roles. Like, you know, name it, let people know that you are interested, because I find that there is a willingness now to increase the leadership in the APS for Indigenous people. So it's there. And I think the biggest thing is to grab every opportunity. I quite often find myself almost drowning, because when the opportunity is there, I take it and then worry about how I'm going to do it later. And I just keep doing that. And like me doing a PhD is the biggest, my friends think it's the biggest joke they've ever heard. But you just keep going and you find a way and just keep grabbing those opportunities, because the opportunities are there, but mob don't put their hand up often enough to do them. And I think that they just need to keep doing that, because if you want to sit at the table, that's what you've got to do.
Well, a bit of advice to Gordon De Brouw: look out, here comes Lisa Conway on the way to the secretary position of the department of whichever you would like to serve as. So, Lisa, you're an inspiration. What a great story. And thank you for being so honest, so open, so humble, and so generous, not only with your time, but your insights. I think there's so much practical wisdom and applied knowledge that I think a lot of our listeners can take away today into their jobs, into their relationships, into their communities, into their houses and into their homes, into their sporting clubs. Because, again, it is one conversation at a time, isn't it, that progress will continue to be made.
Absolutely. You just got to keep chipping away and keep moving in that right direction, and it is going to get there.
Fantastic. Well, Lisa Conway, thank you so much for being a guest on Work With Purpose. What a fabulous conversation. Really, you know, to be inspired by someone like that who is a really, you know, to have had that challenge, that privation, that difficulty, but this sense of just continuing to go on, but then not just the responsibility to herself and her family, but to the wider community, and now to be taking on the challenge of how do we as an APS inside this APS reform become better equipped to be more effective in that cultural responsiveness, which again is that applied end of a cultural awareness. Awareness is one bit, and that's all great, but this responsiveness so that we get better outcomes for our First Nations people. So thanks to Lisa for coming on to the program today. Work With Purpose is produced in collaboration between Content Group and the Institute of Public Administration of Australia, ACT, and supported by our good friends at the Australian Public Service Commission. Now, we're about 86, 87 episodes in, something like that. So there's so much wonderful public service content that you can go back and listen to, not just today's interview with Lisa. So whether you're on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, Google Podcasts — I downloaded Google Podcasts on my phone today for some reason because I couldn't track it down anywhere else. So that's a good place to go as well. But please, yeah, just put us into your consideration set. I know there's loads of content out there, but if you do want to really connect with what's going on in the Australian Public Service and Australian Public Service reform and many of the wonderful stories, we are the place to come for that. So a rating or a review, one last little ask before I go. If you do have time, please, if you can get into those apps and leave a rating or review, it does help us to be found. So more people will be able to listen to the story of Lisa Conway, and more people will be better off because they've listened to that conversation. So a rating or review, please. That would be gratefully accepted. My name is David Pembroke. Work With Purpose will be back at the same time in 2 weeks. But for the moment, it's bye for now.
Work With Purpose is a production of Content Group in partnership with the Institute of Public Administration Australia and with the support of the Australian Public Service Commission.